Panayotita, your graces, your excellencies, distinguished guests, director, kyrios ki kyrii, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this very special occasion. Tonight we are proud to host the second annual lecture of the London Hellenic Society. And I'm pleased to welcome the president of the society, Mr. Yorgos Rhodopoulos, on stage with us tonight. The Hellenic Society, the London Hellenic Society, is a valued supporter of the Hellenic Observatory here at the London School of Economics. And we very much appreciate the range of educational and cultural activities the Society promotes in the United Kingdom. Panayotita, there can be no greater honor for a Philhellene than to have the pleasure of hosting and introducing the Patriarch. His All Holiness, Patriarch Bartholomaeus, heads an institution with a history that extends over 17 centuries. Today, there are some 300 million people worldwide who identify themselves as Orthodox Christians. As such, the Orthodox Church is the second largest Christian church in the world. Let me make a few brief historical points by way of introduction. The church is known as Orthodox because it follows the faith and practices defined by the earliest Christian councils, the first seven ecumenical councils. These early councils, which have defined the fundamental doctrines of the Christian church, were all held in or near Constantinople, as it then was. The position of the Patriarch stems from the 4th century. Historically, it is the Church of New Rome, from the time when, in the year 330 AD, the capital of the Roman Empire transferred to Byzantium. In the same year, Byzantium was renamed Constantinople and New Rome by Constantine the Great. In the 5th century, Constantinople was given equal ranking to Rome. The term ecumenical patriarchate stems from the 6th century and was given exclusively to the Archbishop of Constantinople. The great schism between the churches of the East and the West occurred in 1054. The schism left the churches formally separate and granted Constantinople sole authority and jurisdiction over the Orthodox world. The leadership of Constantinople was also affirmed when the city fell to the Ottoman Empire in 1453. The ecumenical patriarch was now recognized as the ethnarch of the Orthodox peoples. Today, Orthodox Christians across the world see the Patriarch in Istanbul as their spiritual leader, with the Patriarch as the first among equals, alongside the Patriarchs and Primates of various national churches. Hence the use of the title ecumenical to denote worldwide leadership. The status of the Patriarch is accepted by the Russian Orthodox Church, the Catholic Church, the Anglican Church, many other churches. The institutional legal position of the Patriarch is the source of some sensitivity and tension with the Turkish authorities, however. As a result, a number of constraints are placed on the Patriarchate. The succession to the Patriarch must be by someone of Turkish nationality. Yet the only seminary in Turkey able to train a successor was closed down by the authorities in 1971. As you can tell, I'm straying here into sensitive territory. It is not my intention to cause disputes or embarrassment here this evening. Let me say instead that as someone who strongly supports the entry of Turkey into the European Union, I hope the restrictions and sensitivities can soon be overcome. I know many in the European Union would wish this. The fact that the second largest Christian church has its spiritual home in Istanbul should be seen for what it is, clear evidence that Turkey shares a European identity. Our European inheritance comes in part from Turkey. And let me add just one more point. Turkey rightly seeks membership of the European Union on the basis that the European inheritance is not and should not be seen as exclusively Christian. But the same argument can be turned around. Turkey should not see its inheritance as being exclusively Muslim. Protecting the Fanar site, securing the legal position of the Patriarchate, allowing the Halki Seminary to reopen, and recognizing the international status of the Patriarchate. These are items of reform that Turkey will surely be required to undertake before it can be offered full membership of the European Union. It would be a package of reforms that would reflect the very best instincts of the new Turkey, and we are indeed witnessing a new Turkey today. His All Holiness has preached the importance of interfaith understanding and toleration. The Patriarch has acquired broad experience. He was born in present-day Turkey and received his theological training in the Patriarchal School at Halki. He then studied in Munich, in Switzerland, and in Rome. Indeed, he obtained his doctorate from Rome. He entered the priesthood in 1969. In 1973, he was elected Metropolitan of Philadelphia, and he was elected as Ecumenical Patriarch in October 1991. As Patriarch, he's taken a strong lead on a number of issues. He co-sponsored a major conference in 1994 on peace and tolerance, bringing together Christians, Muslims, and Jews. He's condemned racism and nationalism wherever it may occur, but in particular, he condemned it in the context of the tormented region of the Balkans. He has asserted the Christian basis for human rights, particularly relevant to us here in London after the July bombings. He's argued that violence in the name of religion is violence against all religions. And perhaps most prominently of all, to an international audience, he has championed the cause of environmentalism. He has preached the value of caring for the earth that we have inherited. Indeed, he has been termed the Green Patriarch for his work on ecology. In keeping with protocol, the Patriarch's speech tonight will not be followed by a question and answer session. Instead, we have thought it more appropriate that we invite everyone attending this theatre to attend a reception immediately afterwards in the Student Services Centre, the atrium, and you can find the reception by turning left as you exit the theatre, that is on the ground floor of this building. This will be an occasion for you to put your questions to the Patriarch and to meet him in a more informal setting. We have guests here tonight from a number of churches, including the Anglican Bishop of London, Bishop Richard, and we have many members of many faiths and those professing no faith. You are all most welcome. The Patriarch's visit to London is his first for a number of years. We are deeply honoured that his visit was prompted by his acceptance of our invitation to come and speak at the Hellenic Observatory here at the LSE. The director of the LSE, Howard Davis, will make a presentation to the Patriarch later at the reception to acknowledge our very warm appreciation of his visit. Before then, we have the Patriarch's lecture, a lecture for the London Hellenic Society, on the theme of the role of religion in a changing Europe. Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, it is my honour and privilege to ask you to welcome to the London School of Economics His All Holiness Patriarch Bartholomaeus. Thank you.
Θα επιθυμούσα να αρχίσω με ολίγες ελληνικές λέξεις, μεταφέροντας εις όλους τους παρόντας και ιδιαιτέρως εις τους Έλληνας ακροατάς μου, τα σευχάς και την ευλογία της Μητρός Εκκλησίας του Οικουμενικού μας Πατριαρχείου και την προσωπική μου αγάπη και πατριαρχική ευλογία. Your Excellencies, Your graces, your honors, learned sirs. Let us begin this evening by thanking Professor Kevin Featherston, Director of the Hellenic Observatory, and Mr. George Rhodopoulos, President of the London Hellenic Society, for inviting us to deliver this lecture at the renowned London School of Economics and Political Science, to which also we would like to express our gratitude. You have chosen a topic that is of vital importance to all of us without exception: the role of religion in a changing Europe. This is, needless to say, a subject that is of burning concern to us personally in our ministry as Ecumenical Patriarch. In all the countries of Western Europe, the Orthodox flock that is under the spiritual care of the Ecumenical throne is rapidly growing in numbers. It is therefore natural and necessary for us to ask ourselves, does religion still have a role in Europe? What is our vocation as Orthodox Christians in Europe as a whole? The title of our lecture tonight refers to a changing Europe. In what particular ways is Europe undergoing change? Two features come at once to mind: multiculturalism and secularism, or secularization. First, the national boundaries separating one European country from another are becoming less sharp and clearly defined. And this is happening on many different levels: political, economic, and social. None of us are living anymore in a monolithic, pan-ethnic cultural milieu. All of us belong to or find ourselves cast into broader cultural currents. This is true not only of the countries of Western Europe, such as Britain, France, or Germany, but also of the traditional Orthodox lands, such as Greece or Romania. One aspect of this multicultural trend is the ever-increasing scale of immigration. In Europe today, for example, there are between 15 and 20 million Muslims. In Britain, they constitute 2.7% of the population, but in most other countries, the proportion is higher. In Germany, 4.9%. And in France, as much as 8.3%, no less than 5 million Muslims in France. Surely, we should see this not as a threat, but as an opportunity and as a mutual enrichment. Alike, as a result of immigration and of other factors, we Europeans are coming to recognize, in a way that we have never done before, that we belong to one another and need each other. Nations in the contemporary world are not self-sufficient, but interdependent. To Cain's question in the Old Testament story of Cain and Abel, "Am I my brother's keeper?" there can today be only one answer, equally on to the personal and the international level. And the answer has to be, yes, I am. I am my brother's keeper. This does not mean that national loyalty, patriotism, and love of one's native land have ceased to have any meaning. On the contrary, what Alexander Solzhenitsyn said in his Nobel Prize speech 35 years ago still remains fully valid today. The disappearance of nations would impoverish us, no less than if all humans were to become alike, with one personality and one face. Nations are the wealth of humankind, its collective personalities. The very least of them wears its own special colors and bears within itself a special facet of divine intention. But our experience of our own national identity has today to be lived out within a pluralist and multicultural context. The most striking contemporary expression of this multiculturalism is, of course, the emergence of the European Union. From its first beginnings on the 9th of May 1950, when Robert Schuman, as French Minister of Foreign Affairs, proposed the establishment of the European Coal and Steel Community, it has now come to embrace no less than 25 member states, and it continues to expand. As a Turkish citizen, we would like at this point to express our hope that in due course, Turkey will become a full member of the EU when the necessary preconditions of such membership have been met, including, in particular, the recognition of the religious and other rights of minority communities. The admission of Turkey to the EU, so we are convinced, will significantly contribute to rapprochement and reconciliation between the Muslim world and the West. It is true that during recent months, the EU has been passing through a time of crisis. The idealistic vision of the Union's founders has sadly faded. Political leaders in the different states have to ask themselves why so many of their citizens are strongly hostile to the proposed constitutional treaty. Yet, this should not blind us to the remarkable achievements of the EU. For more than 60 years, there has not been a major war in Europe. Probably since the fall of the Roman Empire, there has never been in Europe such a prolonged period of peace. With a minimum of violence and bloodshed, the Iron Curtain has been broken down to a degree unthinkable in the 1930s. The peoples of Europe are today committed to the principles of freedom, justice and democracy. When we Orthodox pray, as we do at every celebration of the Divine Liturgy, for the peace of the whole world, we have good reason to reflect with gratitude on these developments. Yet we know that there is no room for complacency. Peace and freedom are not only a gift from God, but an unceasing task. Along with multiculturalism, a second major feature in today's changing Europe is the growth of secularism. In most countries, especially in the western part of Europe, there has been a dramatic decline in church going. Almost everywhere, with certain notable exceptions, religious groups in Europe are lamenting a lack of candidates for the priesthood and the monastic life. In education and in the total life of society, Christianity is becoming marginalized. All of this leads us to ask, does religion any longer have a role in the future of Europe? It is surely disquieting that in the proposed constitutional treaty, despite protests from many church leaders, there is no explicit reference to the contribution made by Christianity to the formation of the European heritage. Yet we must take care not to exaggerate. Even if levels of church going have fallen in many places, the majority of Europeans, as recent surveys indicate, still affirm that they believe in the existence of a God. In some countries, the proportion of those who do so is surprisingly high. In Malta, 95%. In Cyprus and Romania, 90%. In Greece and Portugal, 81%. And in Poland, 80%. In EU countries as a whole, an overall average of 52% state that they believe there is a God, and only 18% declare that they do not believe in the existence of any sort of God, spirit, or life force. Of course, by no means all those who accept God's existence are actively practicing their faith. Interestingly, in our country, Turkey, the number of those expressing belief that there is a God is as high as 95%. And of these, the great majority are indeed practicing their faith. A modern and democratic political and social structure has to respect the religious wishes and sentiments of its citizens. Religious freedoms cannot be curtailed in the name of secularism. Now, does the message of Orthodoxy matter in a united Europe? Even if in all too many countries of Europe, organized religion is passing through a time of difficulty, religious belief is by no means merely a thing of the past. Christianity in numerous European lands is like a sleeping giant, but according to all indications, the giant is soon going to wake up. Indeed, this has already been happening since the fall of communism in the former Soviet Union. In Russia and Ukraine, since 1989, the number of Orthodox parishes has increased nearly threefold and now exceeds 20,000, whereas in 1989 there were only 18 monasteries. Today there are more than 600. Let us not underestimate the resilience of Christianity. And let us not forget that the founding fathers of the EU, such as Adenauer and De Gasperi, were profoundly Christian in their vision of a unified Europe. With approximately 300 million faithful in Eastern Europe, the Balkans, the Middle East, but also in the New World, the Orthodox Church is a force of unity, a stabilizing factor, and an essential component in the ongoing process to create a new European reality, bridging the Eastern and Western Christian cultures and traditions of the continent. Under the leadership of the Ecumenical Patriarchate, Orthodox dioceses have also been present for a long time in almost all the countries of Western Europe, providing spiritual guidance to the Orthodox faithful. Because of its decentralized structure, Orthodoxy is in a position to reach in a much more direct and effective manner its faithful through its 16 local churches, operating under the coordination of the Ecumenical Patriarchate, first among the equal churches of the Orthodox Commonwealth. Given the global revival of religious faith and attachment to spiritual values of the recent decades, the Orthodox ecumenical message and cultural legacy has assumed greater credibility and has turned into a bulwark against the transcendence of extreme nationalistic, confessionary, and religious contradictions. In this respect, the Patriarchate of Constantinople upholds the work of conciliation of all mankind, the propagation of peaceful coexistence, and the preservation of the natural environment. And thank you, Professor, for mentioning this. Towards achieving these goals, the Ecumenical Patriarchate has been undertaking multifaceted activities, organizing international environmental symposia since 1992, promoting the dialogue and rapprochement among divided Christians, co-sponsoring a dialogue between the Orthodox Church and the European People's Party and the European Democrats since 1996, and promoting interfaith dialogue, starting with the Peace and Tolerance Conference of 1994, which produced the Bosphorus Declaration, an interfaith document which condemns all crimes in the name of religion as a crime against religion. Next week, we have another Peace and Tolerance Conference in Istanbul with the participation of many high-ranking dignitaries of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, organized by the Ecumenical Patriarchate and sponsored also by Mr. Barroso, the President of the European Commission. Historical Constantinople and modern-day Istanbul is a city where religions and cultures converge. Thus, the Ecumenical Patriarchate, with its seat in this city for 17 centuries, has coexisted peacefully and constructively with Islam and Judaism. While contact between Orthodox and Muslims has been an everyday process in multicultural Istanbul, an academic dialogue of friendship and mutual understanding between Christians and Islam started in 1986 in the Orthodox Center of the Ecumenical Patriarchate in Chambéry, Geneva, followed by 9 further conferences. Under these circumstances, Orthodoxy, headed by the Ecumenical Patriarchate, whose headquarters are situated in a predominantly Muslim city, has all the credentials to assume the role of a bridge between Europe and Islam. In the same manner, the staunch support extended by the Ecumenical Patriarchate to Turkey's membership to the European Union is linked to the belief that Europe will benefit greatly by integrating a predominantly Muslim country, willing, of course, to adopt European principles, such as respect for religious freedoms and minority rights. A similar dialogue between Orthodoxy and Judaism has been going on with the blessings and the initiatives of the Ecumenical Patriarchate. We have had so far 5 constructive meetings between Orthodoxy and Judaism. Excuse me. This leads us to consider the spiritual foundation of Europe. Europe, it has often been said, is not simply a geographical area, but an idea. What then, we ask, is the fundamental idea that gives unity to Europe, that constitutes the soul of Europe, to remember Jacques Delors, and that the European Union is seeking, however imperfectly, to embody? The answer can be found in a Jewish saying recorded by Martin Buber in his Tales of the Hasidim. What is the worst thing that the evil urge can achieve? A rabbi is asked, and he replies, to make us forget that we are each the child of a king. As human persons, we are each of us from royal lineage in the spiritual sense. That is to say, we are each and every one of us free. This notion of personal freedom, of the free dignity and integrity of every single human being, lies at the heart of what we mean by the European idea, and it is the primary guiding principle of the EU. It is precisely in this perspective that we can begin to appreciate the role of religion in Europe, for personal freedom is fundamental likewise to the Christian doctrine of human personhood. The truth will make you free. Η αλήθεια ελευθερώσει ημάς, states Christ. Am I not free? Asserts St. Paul, writing to the Corinthians. Emphasizing the element of freedom in God's relationship with the world, the second century epistle to Diognetus affirms, God persuades, he does not compel, for violence is foreign to him. Os pithon, uviazomenos, viagar, u prosesti to Theo, according to the original. God persuades, he does not compel, for violence is foreign to him. This is indeed a golden saying. Would that Christians over the centuries had paid more attention to it, and not only Christians. The cardinal significance of freedom is vividly underlined in the tale of the Grand Inquisitor in Fyodor Dostoevsky's masterwork, The Brothers Karamazov. For the Christian tradition, freedom, the ability to make decisions consciously and with a full sense of responsibility, is the most tremendous thing granted by God to human persons. Without liberty of choice, there is no authentic personhood. As God says to the people of Israel in the Old Testament, I call heaven and earth to witness against you this day, that I have set before you life and death, blessing and curse. Therefore, choose. If, however, we are to appreciate the true meaning of this personal freedom, we have to ask further, what is meant by a person? Here again, the testimony of the Christian tradition is of decisive significance. Is the human animal merely a political animal, politikon zoon, as Aristotle says, or a logical and rational animal, logikon zoon, to use the Stoic phrase? Are we no more than an animal that laughs and weeps, as some have thought? Is the human animal to be seen simply in materialistic and economic terms, as a consumer? Such, unfortunately, is exactly the approach of many citizens today within the EU. They think almost exclusively of what they can get out of the Union in terms of material advantages, not of what they can contribute on a spiritual level. And that is perhaps the chief reason why the EU is passing at present through such a severe crisis. Against this concept of the person as merely an economic entity, a consumer, Christianity insists that as human beings we are zoon theoumenon, not only a political zoon, not only a logikon zoon, but a zoon theoumenon, to use the words of Saint Gregory of Nazianzus, an animal that is being deified, that is called to share in God's glory and to become a partaker of the divine nature. The most important fact about our humanness is our transcendent dimension. We are formed in the image of God, katikona theou. We are endowed, that is to say, with God consciousness, and so we are capable of prayer. We have the capacity to offer the world back to God in thanksgiving, and it is only in this act of offering that we become genuinely human and truly free. We do not expect all this to be stated explicitly in the Constitution of the EU, for the Constitution is a legal document, not a theological treatise. But it is our hope that implicitly, if not explicitly, the foundational documents of the EU will at least be open to such an interpretation. We trust that full recognition will be given to the fact that man does not live by bread alone. Ούκε πάρτο μόνο ζει άνθρωπος. Hitherto we have spoken of personal freedom, but it needs also to be said that our freedom is not only personal, but interpersonal. As human beings, we cannot be genuinely free in isolation, repudiating our relationship with our fellow humans. We can only be genuinely free if we form part of a community of other free persons. Freedom is not solitary, but social. We are only free if we become a prosopon, to use the Greek word for person, which means literally face or countenance. If we turn towards others, looking into their eyes and allowing them to look into ours, to turn away, to refuse to share, is to forfeit liberty. This indeed is specifically what is implied by the Christian doctrine of God. According to the teaching of the Greek fathers, in the image of God means primarily in the image of Christ. To be human is to be Christ-like, for Christ is the supreme model of what it is to be a person. But the phrase in the image of God means also in the image of God, the Trinity. As Christians, we believe in a God who is not only one, but one in three. The Christian God is not merely personal, but also interpersonal. God is not just a unit, but a union. As Trinity, God is not simply the monad, unique, self-sufficient. God is the triad of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, the three divine persons united to one another in the unceasing movement of mutual love that the Greek patristic tradition terms perichoresis, alliloperichoresis. God is communion, kinonia. In the words of Saint Basil the Great, the unity of God lies in the communion, in the kinonia of the Godhead, in the interrelationship of the three persons. As Metropolitan John Zizulas of Pergamon expresses it, His Eminence is here sitting, the being of God is a relational being, a relational being. Without the concept of communion, it would not be possible to speak of the being of God. His Eminence John of Pergamon just finished a new book of him to be soon published under the title Communion and Otherness. Now, if as humans we are formed in the image of the Trinity, then it follows that everything which has just been said about God should be applied also to humankind. We are called to reproduce on earth, so far as this is possible for us, the perichoresis or movement of mutual love that in heaven unites the three persons of the Trinitarian God. This we seek to do not only on the level of our interior life of prayer, not only within the immediate circle of our family and friends, but also more broadly on an economic and political level. Our social program is the doctrine of the Trinity. Every form of community, the workplace, the school, the city, the nation, even the European Union, has as its vocation to become, each in its own way, a living icon of the Trinity. Nations are called to be transparent to one another, just as the three persons of the Trinity are transparent to one another. Such is the role of religion in a changing Europe. To some of you, dear friends, we fear what we have just been saying about the imitation of God the Trinity may appear remote, unreal, over-idealistic. Of course, we do not expect such language to be used in the legal formulations and the official documents of the EU, such as its constitution. But such are the decisive inner convictions that inspire our commitment as Christians to a united Europe. State and church, separation or cooperation? Accepting as we do and must the pluralist and multicultural character of Europe today, What should be our understanding of the relationship between the state and organized religion? There are in principle three main systems for regulating this relationship. There is first the confessional system, whereby the state gives official recognition to one particular religion or church. Secondly, there is the non-confessional system, whereby the state is separated from religion and assumes an attitude of neutrality towards all expressions of religious belief and practice. In the third place, there is the situation whereby the state is officially atheist. Within the European Union, only the first two systems exist. There is within it no example of a state that is officially atheist. As examples of the first system, the confessional, we may take Great Britain, Denmark, and Greece. Within these three countries, there is, of course, full freedom of religious worship and observance. Indeed, this is presupposed by the basic principles of the EU. But a special position is assigned to one particular religious body, to the Church of England here in Great Britain, to the Lutheran Church in Denmark, and to the Orthodox Church in Greece. Most countries in the European Union, however, follow the second system, the non-confessional. This is the case, for instance, with France, Germany, Portugal, Belgium, Holland, and Luxembourg. In the 1970s, Ireland, Spain, and Italy abandoned the confessional pattern, whereby special recognition had been given to the Roman Catholic Church. More recently, in the year 2000, Sweden ceased to be a confessional state. Even in confessional states, such as Great Britain and Greece, the link between church and state is being gradually weakened. Now in Great Britain, the state plays a far smaller role in the appointment of bishops. In Greece, the president of the state is no longer required to be a member of the Orthodox Church. Increasingly, the norm within the EU and within Europe generally is coming to be the non-confessional pattern. Both in the confessional and the non-confessional systems, there are, of course, many variations and in detail. Even where the non-confessional system prevails, it is usually accepted that religion cannot be simply a private matter for each citizen, but it has implications for the public life of the state, and these may be recognized on the legal level. In some non-confessional states, for example, religious bodies continue to play an official role in the educational system. Thus, even in non-confessional countries, usually there is no attempt to establish a total separation between religion and the state. Indeed, so we may legitimately ask, is separation the most appropriate word for us to employ in this context? Instead of using what is essentially a negative word, would it not be better to speak in terms of mutual respect and cooperation instead of separation? It is significant that in what is for Eastern Orthodoxy the most important statement of political philosophy, the sixth novel issued by the Emperor Justinian around the year 534. The key word is the term symphonia, concord, or harmony. Justinian begins by distinguishing the roles of the emperor, that is the civil authority, and the clergy, that is the religious authority. The greatest gifts that God in his philanthropia has given from above to human beings, he says, are the priesthood, hierosyne, and the imperial authority, the imperium, I vasilia. He goes on to specify what the respective spheres in which each authority is competent to act are, and he emphasizes their reciprocal interdependence. The emperor watches over the good order of the church, and in their turn, the clergy pray for the work of the emperor. He continues, for if the priesthood is in all respects without blame and full of faith before God, and if the imperial authority rightly and duly adorns the commonwealth committed to its charge, there will ensure a happy concord, symphonia, that will bring forth all good things for humankind. This evening, we would like to underline in particular the phrase used here by Justinian, a happy concord. Between 6th century Byzantium and Europe in the 21st century, there are obvious and profound differences. But in speaking of a happy concord, Justinian's sixth novel offers us a paradigm for the relationship between the state and religion that is still valid today. Whether we are living in a confessional or a non-confessional system, and as Christians, we can accept either situation, it is our hope that there will exist between religion and the state a symphonia of active collaboration. We should not think only of separation, neutrality, or mutual tolerance, but of a relationship that is far more dynamic and creative. Our Christian attitude towards the total society in which we live is expressed exactly in the statement of St. Paul. He was speaking, it is true, of membership within the church, but we are justified in giving his words a wider application. If one member of the body suffers, all suffer together with it. If one member is honored, all rejoice together with it. All that we have been trying to say this evening can be briefly summed up. Freedom, respect, or the dignity and integrity of each human person is fundamental to our vision of a united Europe. It is equally fundamental to our religious understanding of the relationship between the divine and the human. God persuades, he does not compel. But freedom is not only personal, it is also interpersonal. The self has its being and its fulfillment in the other, communion and otherness. We cannot be truly free, truly personal, unless we are in communion with other three persons. We need you in order to be ourselves. If we make that the guideline in our personal religious life, and if we make that our guideline as citizens of our own nation, of Europe, and of the whole world, then, without doubt, religion will have a vital role to play in a changing Europe. Thank you.
Panayotita, you can see the response of the our guests here in the audience. We are deeply grateful for the presentation. To remind you, we can now invite each of the guests here to come to the reception in the Student Services Center. Can I, before doing that, ask you to please remain where you are now, and we will go with Panayotita to the reception, and then please follow as soon as you can. Can I ask the director, Howard Davis, to help to lead his All Holiness to the reception? We'll now proceed to those steps. Thank you.